A couple of housekeeping matters before we go back into the taping. Well, I'm glad they're enjoying each other's company so much. One housekeeping matter is that I've consulted with as much of the staff as I've been able to on the lunch break, and it's our collective view that we would all benefit greatly from delaying the next meeting by about 2 weeks. So rather than meeting on February 9th, we're looking to February 23rd. We feel that we've just gotten so much information today that we need to digest and kind of sort through and figure out where our voids are, what we still need to gather from the group or other experts. We're almost sure we want to incorporate some additional input from the California Commission and probably use the opportunity to get New Jersey and New York as well, who were not available or able to come today. So in order to do that, we feel that we would, you know, pushing the date out a little bit might help with that too. What we would be asking for there is if you're aware of any, we've done some checking already, if you're aware of any major industry-wide meetings or conferences that are on February 23rd, it is a Friday, sorry about that again, but it's just the day that keeps popping up as most available for us. You know, let us know. Otherwise, we'll send something out to confirm February 23rd. The other housekeeping matter is that, as you know, we haven't had any time for you to ask questions of the panelists, and really this, or the presenters, and really this format doesn't lend itself much to that anyway, because you would have needed to come up to the podium and speak in the microphone. So a suggestion was made, and I think it'll work. We'll send out more details about how to go about this, but we're going to set up, we'll give you a contact person here for you to send by email any questions that you may have that should be directed at any of the presenters that were here today or that we hear from this afternoon. We'll, at our end, sort through those, kind of group them, and then we'll ask the panelists if they would be willing to provide us with answers. Some of them may not have the time to do it, and certainly we'll understand that. But to the extent they can give us those answers, then we'll share those with you either prior to or at least at the next meeting. And our thinking is that by the next meeting, we should at least be able to have some skeletal, is that a fair way to put it, Shane? At least maybe even an outline of what the working group report might look like, so that you have some idea of the direction we're going and we can get some real concrete feedback from you on, you know, where we need to depart or what else we might need to address. Anything else on that? Yes, go ahead. No. We'll have at least a sketchy outline available for you prior to that time, so that we can go through at that meeting and just begin discussing where the group is on each of the points that are being addressed. I mean, some of them we recognize may just be there is some support for it within the group, but not any kind of unanimous or consensus support. But for each one, we'll just try to get a sense of where the individual group members are. Now, really the only thing we're going to, I mean, as far as your subgroup efforts, you know, there still may be things that you owe your subgroup leaders. I'm not sure about that. But essentially, we're not going to be asking you for anything else other than if you have written, you know, questions that you want us to send to the panelists. Other than that, we're just going to be looking for you to come to the next meeting, you know, prepared to discuss all the different areas that will be covered in the report. And then you'll still get an opportunity after that to review a draft of the report and give us comments. Now, we know we're going to start cutting into that time a little bit by delaying the next meeting, but we think it's worth it, and we think we can make up the time in March and April. We had built in a little extra time that was maybe absolutely necessary there. Okay? I think with that, we'll go back on taping, unless we already did. Okay, all right. So people will hear that if they listen. That's okay. Our first presenter of the afternoon is Hank Ryan. Hank is the Executive Director of Small Business California. And he's going to be talking to us about on-bill financing, and specifically about programs that have been successfully implemented in the New England region and in California. And Hank says he thinks he can probably do his presentation justice in about 20 minutes. So if the next panel can be sort of ready to move up around 1:20, we'll be able to keep things moving. Well, actually, I took some of your time. You can go to 1:30. Never mind. Go ahead.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I do represent a Small Business California, which is a statewide membership advocacy group for small business. Energy is one of the sort of global areas we cover, including the small business issues of healthcare, workforce development, workers' comp. We also work very closely with the Center for Small Business and Environment in Washington on energy issues, and I'm a board member of the National Small Business Association. There's a lot of exciting things coming up in terms of energy with our with the changes that have occurred. In terms of visiting here from California, I won't complain about the cold weather. Gene didn't have a lot of luck doing that. And I will say to you that I used to come and talk a bit in 2002 and say to people after our deregulation, "Hi, I'm from California. But I'm really from Connecticut, because deregulation didn't work so well in California. Now I can't say anything about Connecticut." We work very closely with United Illuminating because we're going to feature their financing, and we're looking at they're looking at 22 cents. They're looking into the eyes of their customers who are not happy at 22 cents. So there's some issues to be dealt with there in terms of getting the prices right. I also want to mention that what brought me here is really working with Chris Lynch of the Small Business Development Center of the Wharton School here in Pennsylvania. And he demonstrated through various small business groups a strong interest in access to capital and financing. So ultimately, our being able to share some things that we believe might provide a template, although Pennsylvania is a very different environment than either California or Connecticut. So hopefully we'll be able to touch on some things there that'll be helpful. One thing that I think I want to point out is that small business has a very large footprint. We are essentially somewhere around the area of 40% of the rate base. And ultimately, saving energy for small business, where you don't have decoupling, where you don't have that strong interest, may seem counterintuitive until you think, you know, small businesses have a way of becoming large businesses. And keeping those businesses healthy through managing their controllables, one of which is energy, I think is good for utilities to really pay attention to. Small business people make decisions based on business. And so I think there's a good relationship to be built there. We're very diverse. We come in a lot of different flavors and sizes. But ultimately, we believe we can bring solutions to the marketplace. So with that, I'll ask for the next slide. This, again, talks about Small Business California, gives our website, and this, I guess, will be up on the CPUC or the PUC website and available. So, again, if
yes,
there are any questions.
I think it's already there, actually.
It's already there now.
Yeah,
okay.
But don't go look to go see.
Obviously, just email us, and we'll be happy to try to help. Here's where we are with small business, and I don't need to talk at least regionally about higher energy costs. Here in Pennsylvania, you're looking at much more reasonable energy costs now, right? You've got a situation where your caps are coming off. The one utility that seems to have deregulation looking like it's under control may not have those prices soon. And you've got an issue of, as was mentioned earlier, your capacity is reaching its top. So there's got to be a way to help deal with these things, or we're all going to be wishing we did. When small businesses look to address energy savings, they need certain things to make it happen. If there is a lack of verifiable energy savings, we can't count what we're saving. So it's got to be clear. It's got to be distinct. We can't guess at it, or we won't invest in it. We've got to have some way to deal with cash flow. That really is the key element in small businesses making investments in just about anything, but especially when you're dealing with what we want to call a controllable, you know, you've got to have a way to, for those investments to be made. Small businesses don't like to take out loans. It just is almost asking for trouble, I think, in a lot of small business, you know, the way they think about this. And in working with them over time, that's been a real central feature, is that it's a difficult thing for them to look at. And in terms of the idea of normal financing to invest in energy efficiency, the paperwork and all that goes with it is part of that. We don't like to take out loans. So those are the kind of core areas. How do we get small businesses to move proactively to protect themselves for energy efficiency? Next slide. I'll just read off the slide. There's too much here. But on-bill financing is a utility-based method of providing seamless sign-on-the-dotted line 0% interest financing through the monthly power bill for small business energy efficiency investments. And again, it addresses these costs as a controllable. That's the key element. The other key element is that it's simple. It's easy. Next slide. Now, I'm going to talk about incentives in a second, but ultimately, interest-free is a big deal because, again, it's one less thing to think about for that small business person to make this investment. So the buy down of the cost of funds is a very cheap amount of money to spend to get a larger percentage of small businesses involved in financing their energy efficiency. Now, here's where we get to the third point here in Pennsylvania that doesn't compute. The public purpose funds don't exist here in Pennsylvania. And so how do we work within that framework and yet still provide an avenue for small business to succeed in investing in energy efficiency? We'll talk about that in a second. Good on-bill financing programs have integrity in the fact that they don't have defaults. That is a pure measure of whether or not it's working. If you've got good uptake and your amount of defaults is a very low percentage, then you know it's working. And if something isn't working in this system, you'll end up with defaults or you'll end up with no uptake. So it sort of polices itself in its own way. Next, please. This is the worst slide I have because you can't see very well, but it's right on the bill. Again, it's simple. And in on-bill financing, the way it's designed in Connecticut and how we will be working and designing it in California, in fact, have started. We have served as interveners in that PUC process to help move that forward. It's right on the bill. And that's very important because the difference between paying your electric bill with that added, which is balanced by the savings each month that you get from the energy efficiency investment, that's kind of a no-brainer. But if you're doing it on a separate bill, your defaults go way up. It can be done. There's all kinds of ways for access to capital to happen. But if you put it on a separate bill, it does create some more problems. Oh, sorry about that. Go ahead. So on-bill financing is a cash-neutral proposition. The payments are spread across the payback period. Let's say you have something that you invest in new lighting, and you have a 13-month payback in terms of its return on investment. In other words, the savings pays back over that period of time. Generally, the on-bill financing will run out 14 months. So you have a little positive cash flow, and that small business is willing to invest in that sense. Now, in Connecticut, what they've done, because they're having so much success with this, is that they're now bringing people in to invest more by putting that loan period out to 24 months. So they might have a 13-month payback on an investment, but they've got 24 months to pay it off. That's positive cash flow. In other words, why wouldn't you do this? So again, it helps get over the hump of getting that participation. Next slide. The United Illuminating Small Business Energy Advantage program in Connecticut averages $7,800 per installation. I can tell you in California, we have a lot of programs. We give away a lot of money. And our average installation for small business lighting is around $1,300. So the difference is that the loan in this case is much higher. And in the case of the rebate, that's about a third in Connecticut where they have rebates. But that is also about the amount of savings on average that the small business sees each year. So that's $2,600 that after 2 years of paying this off is now profit coming back to them. So it's a significant amount of money. Next slide. The best on-bill financing programs should be comprehensive. And what I mean by that is that not that they should cover everything in the building. I owned a restaurant and we had a lot of things that we could save energy on, and we tried, but if someone came in from a utility company or another conservation group and said, hey, we want you to do this and this and this and this and this, and I would have said, listen, I got to serve lunch. You know, it's just too much to handle. But the comprehensiveness I'm talking about is where the footprint of what you're addressing. If it's a shoe store, do all the lighting. If it's a deli or a convenience store, do the refrigeration, because you want to hit them where they live in terms of this investment and their savings. Trickling in isn't the way to make that small business mind think, hey, this makes sense. Now what do I invest in? Okay. It ensures that the savings will be visible on the energy bill. And another key element for on-bill financing is, as I said, the application process really needs to be signed on the dotted line in one form or another. And every time that we see that that's not done, it costs more to run the program, because it costs more to get outreach. It costs more to get people to sign. You've got a lower percentage of intake. So those are all things to try to keep your costs down. Next. This is an example. Now, I didn't say who United Illuminating is. If you don't know, it's a small utility in southwestern Connecticut, about 300,000 customers. Northeast Utilities, or CL&P, Connecticut Light and Power, is the big utility in Connecticut. They also have on-bill financing. But theirs is off-bill, and their defaults are higher. So we like to feature United Illuminating. This is a typical project. I had a little trouble seeing the screen from the distance you are. I'm not sure if you can see this, but this was in the good old days of 2004 when their rates were 9 cents a kilowatt hour. But ultimately, in this case, the lighting and the refrigeration were both hit hard. And essentially, the positive cash flow amounted to $266 a month after the period of financing, and $72 a month while it was being financed. So it's positive cash flow in both instances. And that amount of money in a convenience store is enough to be noticed, and that's what really matters. Next, please. One of the most important things about on-bill financing and programs that run in a long, year-by-year fashion that are successful is that energy efficiency doesn't have an institutional base on the small business side that we can look at reliably enough. In other words, the contractors out there, the programs that run, they may run from year to year, they might come 1 year, they're gone the next year, and so people are running after different programs. It doesn't build a good institutional base. What one thing on-bill financing does, and again, the Connecticut illustration is such that they have 8 contractors that they manage in United Illuminating that have been doing this now for 6-7 years. And they, you know, a few rotate out every year, but that core of 4 or 5 contractors that they've been working with now for a long time, they get to develop their workforce. They get to invest in their workforce, give them good jobs. And that's really where the value of energy efficiency comes into play here when we look at it seriously, that we're not just hitting and running. We're really building the ability to put profits back into where businesses are losing it. One thing that United Illuminating provides and offers is contractor management software. What we're trying to do as Small Business California, we are fortunate enough to manage an EPA grant for the next couple of years that focuses on bill financing and food service, two very challenging areas in the small business arena, but to try to help foster things that can bring these things forward. And contractor software is a big piece of that puzzle. It doesn't need to be anything other than managing those contractors, making sure that the investments go into the parameter for whatever on-bill design you have. But it's got to be done that way, or again, your costs go up. Next slide. We were very pleased to see that after a couple years of lobbying the CPUC beginning in 2003, and in fact, it was so wonderful to hear Jean Clinton on the phone this morning. She tried to get on-bill financing in 2002 in California. She was head of the California Power Authority, and it didn't work. She just tried her heart out, and just—I'll just say it—she got stomped. It was not a good situation because, let's face it, there's work involved here. There's a lot of issues of having to deal with programs that are difficult and new, and the utilities just didn't want anything to do with it. We took the advantage of learning from that experience and working very closely with Jean Clinton and others in California to form a real team effort to try to make sure that we approached it from a successful base, looking back at programs like United Illuminating, and to try to nurture this forward. And we're in that process now in California. Now, what we've done in California is a little different than what we kind of planned on in the beginning. We have four investor-owned utilities and about, I don't know, 12 or 15 publicly owned utilities. The investor-owned utilities, three of the four went ahead with on-bill financing. And we've got a lot of programs. So instead of just sort of a rifle shot of a couple of technologies, keep it simple, you know, go in there and make this work on a small scale, all of our utilities said, okay, we're going to put on-bill financing over our 72 different technologies all at once. And lo and behold, we've spent the last year with our prices very high. And the bottom line is California isn't Connecticut, so we've got to deal with what we have, and those utility managers are just trying to deal with what they have in terms of their programs and cover as much as possible. But I think what we're learning is that well-designed, contractor-driven programs that go towards a few technologies and start small is the way that it's going to succeed. And you don't need to go into a place and attack everything at once. You can go in once with a loan and do the lighting. And the small business user, small business says, hey, you know, that made sense. I made this investment. It didn't hurt, and I made a profit. You go in and do their refrigeration. You go in and do their HVAC. United Illuminating has as many as three different on-bill financing programs in the same business going at the same time in different phases because you're teaching small businesses not to say, hey, what are you going to do to help me? Small businesses don't do that well. We like to attack the problem and see what we can do to solve it if we're given the right tools to do so. And that's what United Illuminating has done so well. The one great thing about on-bill financing in California, where we're going to blaze some new territory, we will be approaching new technologies. Demand ventilation for restaurants is coming online. Solar water heating for commercial pools, believe it or not, all can help drive these single-use technologies. And one of the greatest things we're seeing, and Connecticut's seeing the same thing, is public investments in on-bill financing. Our colleges have as hard a time investing in efficiency as businesses. They've got all kinds of institutional, you know, silos that make it difficult. On-bill financing helps separate those capital issues and those operational issues. And what we're doing with that is it's a safe playground to be in for on-bill financing because usually municipals don't default. Usually counties don't default. We've had a couple. But ultimately, it allows for those technologies and the programs in California to develop and hopefully bring new ideas to other parts of the country. Next. And I mentioned a couple of these. Compressed air is something that National Grid in Massachusetts has as a technology that's working really well for them. And when we're looking at keeping our businesses vital, what we have left of manufacturing in this country, we really want to hang on to, I would think. And that's an area where compressed air can go in as a technology for efficiency, and done properly can lead into a very difficult area that's just as tough to touch as small business per se. Small manufacturing, you know, it's kind of like the restaurant. Hey, listen, I'm busy. You know, they've really got to have one thing that you can show them that is done properly, and that, hey, this guy down the street did it, that guy did it. We're just replicating this thing over and over again to teach people that efficiency truly is profits that are being recovered through energy that simply does not need to be used. For all of you selling energy, I hope I'm not insulting you. In California, we're very trained to look at efficiency as an energy source. Next slide. And we don't have any more slides. I tried to review this and my computer died before I got up here, so I'm kind of flying blind. But I hope that this has provided some information that's helpful, and we'll keep you posted. And I believe that you've got an opportunity here in Pennsylvania that no one else has, because you don't have any PGC funds. You're not going to have any rebates that I can see coming. However, because of that, you don't have small businesses expecting things for free or with huge rebates. So just 0% interest on bill financing probably is enough to leverage a number of businesses. And I hope that you'll have the opportunity to start small, to start in an area where you can target it, and use just the financing tool alone to see a way to help small businesses invest and become stronger so they can become larger businesses and keep the base here going. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Hank. If we could go ahead and have the next group of panelists come up. There are chairs up front for all of you.
No, that's Ruben. I'm Chris. Chris,
you can present from here or there.
Whatever order makes sense.
What I'll do is I'll introduce all four, and then we can just go through them in the order they're on the agenda. First, we're going to hear from Chris Neamy, who is Director of Planning and Evaluation Programs in Vermont, specifically at the Vermont Energy Investment Corporation. Then we'll hear from Bill Steigelman, who's right here. He's Senior Energy Consultant at Lockheed Martin Information Technology, and he'll be focusing on small commercial and industrial customers and Energy Star. Mark Millen is a Senior Associate with ICF International. He'll be talking about residential energy efficiency, specifically also with Energy Star. And then Ruben Brown, who's President of the E-Cubed Company, and he'll be giving us a little bit broader perspective on some of the residential energy efficiency programs that have been implemented from all along the East Coast. So with that, Chris.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'll start by giving a quick background on who I am and who VEIC is and what we do, just to give you some context for what I'm going to say later. VEIC is a nonprofit organization with a staff of about 110 and an annual budget now approaching about $30 million. We do a variety of different things in the energy efficiency and renewable energy fields. The group that I manage mostly does consulting on analysis of markets for efficiency and renewable energy technologies, design and evaluation of programs to promote those technologies, and support the folks who are exploring policies to promote those kind of programs and those technologies. VEIC, other parts of VEIC with which I interact a fair amount, but it's not my full-time job. And perhaps what DEIC is best known for right now is that we run Efficiency Vermont, which is the statewide energy efficiency utility, the first one created in the nation. We've been doing that for now 7 years, which means that we administer all the system benefit charge, electric system benefit charge funds in the state of Vermont. And I'll talk a little bit more about some of that later. So I tried to pack as much into this as I possibly could. It's going to be a struggle for me to get through it all. I'll try to skip over some stuff, but at least you've got all of the slides as background to refer to, if you like, for the stuff that I'm going to skim over. I'm going to try to quickly cover four topics. One is just a real quick background on what the leading states and provinces in North America are doing with respect to spending on energy efficiency. The second is a quick review of the steps one might ideally go through in constructing a portfolio of efficiency programs. The third is outlining my take on what the last couple of decades of experience with energy efficiency programs across North America suggests are keys to good programs. Where is the state of the art today? And then four, just briefly touch on what food for thought for you all, what might be some suggestions for priority programs for you to consider. Go ahead. So with respect to spending, and I'm sorry, this is not too easy to read, probably, if you're in the back, but the leading states and provinces in North America are currently spending between 2 and 5% of electric revenues on energy efficiency programs. There are about 10 states or provinces that are at that level, including my own. Three of them are at about 3% or higher. And in Vermont's case, that's where we were about 2 years ago. And then several months ago, our regulators, after being instructed by the legislature to look into the issue, suggested that we were going to ramp up spending in Vermont in 2008 to 4.7% of electric revenues. To give a little context for what that might mean for Pennsylvania, according to the information I was able to glean from some national documents the Energy Information Administration holds, 2% of spending in Pennsylvania would be something like $230 million a year. Now, you wouldn't want to start there. You can't start at the place where some of the leading folks have already gotten to. It might be reasonable to expect a 2 or 3 year ramp up to get to those levels, but that's just food for thought. On the gas side, for whatever reason, and I think it's probably largely because there hasn't been as much regulatory attention until the last several years on the gas side as there has been on the electric side, the leading gas DSM efforts tend to be a little bit less in terms of spending as a share of revenue, somewhere in the 1.5% to 2% range. So, ideal steps to constructing a DSM portfolio. I've identified five here. I'm mostly going to focus on the first one, just because of time limitations. But the first one is to develop your policy objectives. There are many different objectives you might want to pursue with energy efficiency or demand-side management programs. The next couple of steps have to do with trying to understand your markets. Where are the efficiency opportunities in the state? And then prioritizing programs and then developing them. So, go ahead. So with respect to the question of policy objectives, there are a number that I put forward here as ones that you might consider that most of the jurisdictions that have pursued this have given significant consideration to themselves. The first is to maximize economic benefits. Energy efficiency programs reduce energy costs. They reduce transmission and distribution system costs. They reduce generation costs. And, of course, they have environmental benefits as well. And usually, one of the criteria that regulators impose on anyone who's delivering these programs is to get as much bang for the buck and from a societal cost-effectiveness perspective. So that's one, and it's usually at the top of the list. The second one is to have some balance in your portfolio. Make sure that you're thinking both near-term and long-term. The distinction between what people sometimes call resource acquisition programs that are designed to get savings now, and longer-term market transformation programs where you're looking not just to how many megawatt hours I can save this year, but also to trying to make some fundamental changes in the way the market works, so that 5 years from now, maybe you don't have to spend as much to move the market, or in some cases, you can get out of the market altogether because it will have moved itself to a place where it's sustainably making those investments. Equity. Make sure there's something for everybody. And in my state, in the programs that we deliver across Vermont, we have a variety of performance indicators that our regulators have indicated that they're going to look to see judge how well we're doing. One of them is what are the economic net benefits we're delivering? But another one is what are the benefits we're delivering in each county relative to the money each county is putting into the system benefit charge? They want to make sure there's some sort of geographic equity. They want to make sure there's equity across customer classes. They've told us that we could spend, I think the numbers are something like 60% on commercial and industrial customers, 40% on residential. We can move within 5 percentage points in any given year of those numbers, but if we go beyond that 5% limit, they want to hear about it and understand why. Make sure that you're doing something to reach hard-to-reach customers who don't easily or as easily participate. And that's both low-income customers and oftentimes small commercial customers are fit into that category as well. And some of the previous speakers' discussions about on-bill financing address that. And the last one that people often talk about are minimizing lost opportunities. Now, what does that mean? We typically split energy efficiency investments into two broad chunks. One we call lost opportunities, the other we call discretionary retrofit. Lost opportunities mean time-sensitive opportunities. When a new building is being built, when a new air conditioner is being purchased, if you don't influence the decision at the time the architect is designing the building or the builder is building the building, you're stuck with that inefficient building for a long time. And if you want to go later and try to make it more efficient, it's going to cost you a heck of a lot more than if you'd gotten it at the time it was being designed and constructed. And the reality is that it would almost be impossible to make it as efficient after the fact as you could have if you've integrated those efforts into the initial design. Because those investments, new buildings, new equipment, have 20, 30, 50-year lives, many jurisdictions require prioritizing going after those opportunities. If you don't go and install insulation in a house that could have insulation upgrade next week, you could do it next year, and all you would have lost is 1 year's worth of savings. You won't have lost the opportunity to actually make the cost-effective investment. Now, I want to make the point that these different policy objectives can pull you in different directions. Some of them aren't necessarily mutually exclusive. A lot of market transformation programs bring you near-term benefits as well, but they aren't completely overlapping either. And one of the charges of anyone delivering these programs, if they have guidance from regulators that they want all of these policy objectives addressed, is to try to balance how you approach markets given that. Okay. Okay, keys to good programs. I think I've distilled this down to six keys. The first is that there's clarity on the objectives, and that relates to the points I was just making. The second is, in my experience, establishing ambitious performance goals is critical. And I would agree with the comment made earlier this morning by the gentleman from the Edison Electric Institute that performance incentives for effectively going after efficiency, cost-effective efficiency opportunities is a good thing. And that's true whether you're talking about incentives for the utilities themselves, if they're going to be the administrators, or if you're going the route of third-party administration like we have in Vermont and like we are about to have in New Jersey. And those performance incentives, however, need to be tied to aggressive performance goals. Aggressive but achievable. And I've lived on both sides of those debates. My company lives under performance targets that the regulators have set for us that we sometimes think are overly ambitious. On the other hand, I've worked for consumer advocates and others negotiating with utilities and others about what those performance targets ought to be. So I appreciate the tension that can sometimes be there. The third key, in my view, is comprehensive approaches. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about this later. The fourth is what I call a markets approach. Again, I'll define that shortly. The fifth is leveraging other efforts so that you're taking as much advantage of what's already there in the market to work with as possible. And lastly, investing in, from the very beginning, in quality assurance and quality control and evaluation. So real quickly, with respect to clarifying objectives, you want to understand what is the primary role of an efficiency program in your portfolio. And I gave some examples of from residential programs of what that might look like. Residential new construction, people often think of as most focused on long-term market transformation. Residential central air conditioning provides, in this climate, not huge amount of savings on the energy side, but substantial savings on system peak. Lighting. Lighting is one of those, compact fluorescent light bulbs is one of those measures where it's all about the energy savings. You can get lots of energy savings, and it's also about equity because every customer can afford to buy a $2 or $3 light bulb. Home performance with Energy Star. It's a mix of market transformation and several other objectives. And low income it's really all about equity. So one kind of last point about this is that usually the best programs address multiple objectives. I've just highlighted here what might be the number one objective for several of these programs, but they all have elements of several. Okay. Setting aggressive goals. I talked about this a little bit. I'm not going to go too much further into it, but the key is understanding your market and what the potential is in your market. That's one key. A second one is look real closely at what others in similar markets have accomplished with similar programs. And I gave a couple of examples here get the juices flowing on this subject. Energy Star homes, the leading states that have started promoting homes being constructed to that standard, got market shares of 15 to 20% within 3 to 5 years. Compact fluorescent light bulb sales through retail channels like Home Depot and other stores. The leading states are getting sales of about 1 CFL per household per year. And the best low-income programs are typically getting about 15% savings off of the average customer's heating bill. Okay. Now, comprehensiveness. There's a couple things to say about this. And I think it's natural when we think about energy efficiency programs to think about, well, we want a program for furnaces, or we want a program for light bulbs, or technology-focused programs. And I guess I want to suggest that's the old generation of programs from back in the 90s. And there's two reasons why we've moved or are moving away from that. The first is that we've gotten a little more sophisticated about our thinking, the energy efficiency community broadly. And the second is that particularly on the residential side, but on the commercial side as well, most of the big hit, easy widget savings have been addressed. In the heating realm, efficient furnaces only get you 10 to 15% savings anymore, and they're going to get you even less soon because the Department of Energy is now talking about ratcheting up the minimum efficiency standards for new furnaces. I'm sorry, 2006, January of 2006, the federal standard for central air conditioners changed from SEER 10 to SEER 13. That means that there's not much headroom left between what is now standard efficiency from a nameplate rating on central air conditioners and what is considered high efficiency, which is now 14 or 15. Going from SEER 13 to SEER 14 is less than a 7% savings. So we've gotten a lot of the savings already now through standards. The same is true for water heaters, although there's some new generations of technologies that could come onto the market that would change that. The same is true for appliances. The average refrigerator sold back in the early 90s consumes two and a half times what the average new refrigerator consumes today because we've gone through a couple of rounds of federal appliance standards. Lighting is the one kind of widget opportunity that's left to us that has any significant savings on the residential side. On the other hand, there are major savings potentials that have been largely untapped on systems, HVAC systems. The biggest savings to be had in a home now with central air conditioner is not on getting it to go higher than SEER 13. It's on getting the thing sized right and installed right and the duct system designed right and sealed and so on. Those savings swamp any savings you can get from new equipment, efficient new equipment. The thermal envelope of the building offers significant savings potential. And even in hot water, people are starting to look, particularly in California, very closely at the design of hot water distribution systems. You know, we lose a lot of energy from hot water systems because, you know, in California, you've got the water heater in the garage, and you're running hot water pipe, you know, hundreds and hundreds of yards, it seems sometimes, as our houses get bigger, to get to the kitchen. You know, it's the reason why you turn on the faucet and you got to let it run for 2 minutes before hot water shows up. There's a lot of energy loss in that system. You wash your hands for 30 seconds, you turn it off, and you've got all this hot water sitting in the hot water pipes. So they're increasingly focusing on water heating distribution systems as opportunities for significant savings, much more than is possible by getting your new standard electric water heater from 0.9 energy factor to 0.92. There's just not much headroom there anymore. Okay. System approaches have other advantages as well. First of all, they often focus on quality of design and installation, which makes sure that the widgets that you're installing are actually delivering on their nameplate efficiency. And secondly, they often provide non-energy benefits that customers care a lot more about in some cases than the energy savings. They make sure that the home has is more comfortable, that the heating and cooling equipment lasts longer, that you don't have to wait 2 minutes for the hot water to show up at your tap, and so on. Okay. Okay, the fourth key, a markets approach. So what does this mean? It really means putting yourselves in the shoes of the market actors with whom you're going to interact. For too many years, too many of us design programs around our own bean counting requirements. And when you're talking to Home Depot or you're talking to an HVAC contractor, they don't care about that stuff, and B, if you make it difficult for them, it's difficult already for us to get their attention. And if you start putting additional hurdles because to make it convenient for us, you're going to lose a lot of potential participants. So we need to understand who the key market actors are, what barriers they face, what are their business models, and how can we work with them? What's the underlying value proposition we're making to them? The second point I want to make on this is that we need to understand what are all the barriers in the market to investments in efficiency and design a portfolio of strategies that address all of them. If we miss key ones, we're not going to get very far. And building strong relationships with trade allies is critical. And of course, this means that we have to be more than engineers. We have to have good business and people skills too. I'm not going to walk through these. You probably can't read them anyway, but I just gave a couple of examples of how you might map strategies onto market barriers for both residential new construction, and I think the next one is lighting, which you can go to. Yeah, CFL sales. So you can read those at your leisure. Okay, next. So another element of thinking about markets, you know, which gets to, you know, the historical way we've often done bean counting is, you know, we've got residential programs and we've got commercial programs. We've got new construction programs. We've got existing building programs. And you can go ahead and click some of these things. So, you know, C&I new construction fits neatly into that quadrant. Residential new construction fits into the quadrant to its right. And so on. You can walk through a couple more. Efficient products is usually considered a residential program, residential HVAC. Low income, of course, is existing residential customers. And lastly, there's commercial and industrial products. So this is the standard way practitioners of demand-side management historically thought about how to structure their programs and their markets. Okay. You can go to the next one. And you can whip through to get all of them in the right place. The reality is the markets don't work that way. Efficient products. I'm sorry, you can go back one. Efficient products are sold, if you go to Home Depot, Home Depot's customers are not just residential customers, they sell to small businesses too. They don't just sell for existing homes and existing small businesses, they sell for work that's being done in new homes. We have to understand the business propositions of the people that we're working with and make this work for them, not for us. A good example here is mixed-use development. This what got us thinking about this really hard in Vermont, and I know that PG&E in California has adopted this model as well a year or two ago. We had a developer come to us saying, "All right, I'm building this. I have this new construction project. I've got 200 units of housing. 50 of them are low-income subsidized housing. 150 are market-rate housing, and there's going to be a bunch of commercial space too. Can you help me?" And we, you know, the first thought that went through some people's minds was, okay, well, let's see, we have a low-income program, we can do the 50 units through that one. We have a non-low-income new construction program, we can have that program manager talk to them. We've got a commercial program, we've got that somebody else to talk to them. And then we thought, well, this is crazy. This guy's going to bonk us in the head and leave and never talk to us again. We had to come up with a single point of contact to deal with this person, and all the accounting of which bin that we put the savings, he doesn't want to know anything about that. That's our problem, and we have to sort that out. To this day, I have a lot of conversations with people in different parts of the country about energy efficiency programs, and we've done over the last 10 years work in 25 different states or provinces, and we're doing work right now in about 10. Including neighboring New Jersey, where we're part of the team that just won the contract led by Honeywell to deliver residential efficiency and renewable energy programs in the state. We talked to folks in a lot of different states about promoting compact fluorescent light bulbs, and they say, "Well, we've got, you know, you have to be a residential customer to be eliminable." We eliminated that limitation a couple of years ago, and in our state, we're now getting a third of our savings from CFLs coming from small business customers who are going into Home Depot to buy those products. You can go to the next one. Another example is HVAC contractors. A lot of HVAC contractors serve residential customers. They serve small business customers. They're dealing with existing buildings. They're dealing with new construction. And in some cases in New Jersey, we're now finding that some of them are interested in becoming PV installers. So we don't want to be having five different people talking to them about five different programs, which, God forbid, because this is sometimes true, have five different sets of technical standards that they have to meet with different rebate forms and different everything else. We need to make this as simple as possible for these folks, or we're not going to get anywhere close to what our real potential is. So program silos, if you let them, will create huge problems. Conflicting performance standards, transaction costs that are way too high for the people that really matter, and inefficiencies too. So what's the answer to this? Be flexible. Make it easy for these people to work with you. Give them single points of contact, single forms, single sets of standards. Do joint initiatives with industry wherever you can. And make sure you're capturing as many of the synergies across program types as you can. Put yourself in their shoes. Okay, the fifth key, leveraging other efforts. The Energy Star is a great brand that we can leverage. Industry initiatives. There are a number of those that have been undertaken jointly by folks across a number of different states, reaching out to manufacturers and suppliers of a variety of different products. The other fuel, some of the places I've worked with, you would substitute the word evil for other. It's gas if you're electric, and it's electric if you're gas. There's great synergies or potential synergies for working across fuels. And of course, working with neighboring states. And now we have some federal tax credits potentially to take advantage of too. The more we take advantage of all of these things, the less we have to invest ourselves to make this work. Okay. I talked a little bit about this earlier in broad terms, so I won't belabor it. You can go on to the next one. So recommended program priorities, I offered a few suggestions here. On the residential side, Energy Star Homes, it's a comprehensive program which I think offers great potential. HVAC, residential HVAC, but not just the equipment, focus on the quality of the installation. Retail lighting, it's the one thing you can get a really big bang for that has something for everybody and savings that you can get at a utility cost, levelized utility cost of about a penny a kilowatt hour or less. Home performance with Energy Star, it's a retrofit program where you train and certify contractors who really know what they're doing with building science and then promote them so that when customers have a problem and they don't know where to go, now you've helped them figure that out. And low income. On the commercial side, new construction, We often talk about the next two, a combination of prescriptive rebates for those widget things where there are savings opportunities. For some customers, that's all they want to do. For some customers, that's their way, that's their introduction to you, and then you can start working with them on moving to more comprehensive approaches, particularly for the larger customers. And there's some opportunities to with programs that have been pursued in different parts of the country to certify building operators who are actually managing the day-to-day energy use in a building. Okay, and I won't belabor these either. You could read them in the slides. But I gave several examples of programs across the country that might serve as models for each of these. You can go to the next one, and the next one, and one more, and one more. Okay, so I'd be happy to try to follow up depending on the timing with additional questions anyone might have. And I also noted that there's a couple of different resources you can look for, exemplary programs. ACEEE, the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy, over the last several years has published reports on exemplary gas DSM programs, exemplary electric DSM programs, and exemplary low-income programs. And the California folks have invested a lot in identifying best practices DSM programs from all over the country. That's in a report that I believe you can get off the California PUC or the California CEC's website. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chris. As Bill works his way to the podium, I just wanted to, even though most of you already know this person, I just wanted to make sure you're all aware that we have been joined in the front table by Vice Chairman Jim Colley. Vice Chairman was the one who authored the motion that was adopted by the Commission unanimously in September to reconvene this working group and submit specific recommendations to the Commission. So I wanted to point out that he's here supporting us yet again. And also, a little birdie told me that Commissioner Pitts and Gurley is in the back of the room. And you might know that Commissioner Pitts and Gurley is the Commission's representative in the MADRI effort. So she's has a strong interest in this issue as well. All right, so with that, we'll go to Bill.
Thank you.
All right.
Good afternoon, everyone. Lockheed Martin, EPS, EES, what's that? Well, you all heard of Lockheed Martin, but you probably don't realize it has a significant presence out of the military and out of the aerospace field in operating and supporting civilian government programs. Up until a year ago, I was in the EES, is Energy and Environmental Services. We were part of Aspen Systems Corporation. Exactly a year ago, we were acquired by Lockheed Martin and placed within the Business Process Services as BPS organization. So it's what I'm talking about here about industrial efficiency programs is really an outgrowth of the work that Aspen Systems has been doing for several years, as you'll see, in the efficiency field. And some brand new programs that began as Aspen and are now Lockheed Martin. What you're going to hear is a sort of a specialized focus on one segment of the market. Chris's presentation was covering everything, and we're all familiar with residential and C&I programs and the classic lighting, HVAC, and all that are focused on buildings. What's different here is a focus on industrial processes. They're custom measures, not prescriptive measures. There's many other programs that take care of those, and we're not disparaging those, but this is one of those neglected marketplaces that shouldn't be neglected for reasons I'll hopefully make clear. I'm going to be talking about three programs. Next slide. The Production Efficiency Program, which we've operated for the Oregon Energy Trust since 2002, so it's 5 years. There's really two electric utilities there whose customers are supporting a spectrum of programs. The Production Efficiency one is just one of the portfolio programs, and that's the one we handle. Two utilities are PacifiCorp, formerly Pacific Power and Light, and Portland General Electric. And there's We operate throughout the state, but the service area of Pacific Corps are scattered all over the state in little pockets. So we go to wherever the customers are, and there are a lot of industrial customers out in the hinterland. And, of course, heavy in the Portland area and the industrialized western part of Oregon. The Industrial Energy Efficiency Program, operated by Southern California Edison, and the Heavy Industry Program, we operate on behalf of Pacific Gas and Electric. Next slide. Now, here are the program goals. 101 million kilowatt hours just in 2007 in Oregon. And we've been meeting or exceeding an annual goal every year, sometimes 25-30% exceeding the goal. The program, we usually run out of money in the incentive funds and have to throttle back in the last couple of months of the year. It's been very successful. The SCE and PG&E programs are very similar and very new. They both began last year. They were. We heard this morning the folks from California talk about the 2006-2008 group of programs. This is part of that. $2 billion in total spread all over, all sectors, slice and dice every which way. So what we're talking about is a small piece out of that big pot. So the Southern Cal Edison work began in April. We had thought it was going to start in February, but there's delays in getting regulatory approvals and everything. But the goal is almost as big, 105 million kilowatt hours, but that's over the whole term of the program. And finally, the PG&E program is smaller, 15 million kilowatt hours of electricity, but 1.6 million therms of natural gas savings, because PG&E is both a gas and electric utility. The other two are electric only. That one just started this summer. It was really started in the fall. My role is to support both programs, and it was key. I wrote the proposals and was involved in hiring our staff out there. Next slide. So the program objectives are to assist. I have two slides on objectives. The first slide covers assist the industrial firms, identify what opportunities they have. This, as you'll see in a few minutes in another slide, is one of the big barriers. But point out to them what they can do to reduce their operating costs. Help them to install energy-efficient systems by providing financial incentives. So there's two pieces there, technical support and dollars. The objective is for them to reduce their operating costs per unit of product. Also improve product quality and their production rate. And reduce waste, pollutants, and greenhouse gas emissions, and that's often required or a big factor. As we heard this morning, and we all probably know, California just announced a greenhouse gas emission reduction initiative. So we expect all the manufacturing plants, industrial plants, will be told they have to meet some target. And one way to do that is to upgrade their equipment. And there we are. No. Bottom line objective here is to keep the customer, the utility customer, as a customer. Keep the plant from being closed down and moved somewhere else. Close this one and start one up, or increase production somewhere else where costs are lower. Because the utilities want to keep their industrial load, and all of us should want. Because the industrial sector provides a lot of stability economically, paying taxes, property taxes, sales taxes to the state, various business taxes, and also employment that support the other sectors of the economy. If you don't have people, nobody's going into Home Depot or any of the other stores or restaurants. Oh, the other benefits are societal benefits, which are typical of all the energy efficiency programs, reduce greenhouse gas emissions and other emissions from both power plants and the customer site, reduce peak demand, which reduces the need for new electric power infrastructure, power plants, T&D, and reduces electricity price. Because peak demands set the price. And if you can cut the peak, you cut the price substantially. And, as I said, strengthen the local economy and all of those benefits. And that's where industrial programs are different. And our focus is on large plants. There's other programs providing prescriptive and other services to smaller manufacturers. Our focus in all three programs are on the large. Next slide and the next. So the program strategy is to mitigate barriers. Go in and provide the plant management with information about opportunities to reduce their operating costs. And give them information, accurate information, on the cost effectiveness of the various things that they could be doing, these various opportunities. Give them product information from hopefully multiple vendors of things that have been done other places. And as Chris talked about a systems approach, this is a systems approach. We're focused on the process systems. We may also improve the lighting and cooling, but that's secondary to improving the manufacturing processes and the emission control processes in the plant. Now, in the typical plant, they have smart people, but they have busy smart people. They just have too much to do to go have the time to research these opportunities and gather the information. So this technical support has been shown from our track record up in Oregon to be a key to success in making these large industrial programs succeed. The other barrier is payback periods are too long. So we come in with some financial incentives and also show them how to take advantage of the various tax incentives that are also available. There's also the concern that the project may not be successful. So we have reputable experts providing the information to them. And that's the first point under the mitigation by providing experts to do the studies and give them information, provide the financial incentives, and provide quality assurance services. Next. So one of the early steps is to conduct detailed technical studies. And we use what we call project champions. When we first go to the plant, we ask them, do you routinely use a consultant to do your process studies? You have confidence in you? Think they do good work? Well, we'll hire them. We'll give them a subcontract to do a further analysis to come up with a comprehensive list of opportunities and analyze them. If they don't have someone to suggest, then we bring in some experts on our own staff, some we have a stable of consultants we can call on. These are comprehensive analyses and no cost to the customer. One of the keys also, you can imagine if you're running a plant and today I walk in and say, I'll do a walk through an energy study for you, but I need somebody to walk me around, show me around the plant, talk to me about what you do. And 2 weeks later, somebody else comes in and says, I can give you a demand response program, the utility sponsoring, but I need to understand your plan, so give me somebody to walk me around the plant. The idea is we're there, we'll do this study, and we'll analyze all opportunities, demand response, renewable energy, combined heat and power, and the traditional energy efficiency upgrades, all included in our analysis. We can review their purchase specs. We don't do the design, but we'll, if they want, look over their specs before they send them out to buy something to make sure it's meeting the objectives. And we do a post-installation inspection to make sure what was put in was really what they agreed to up front in order to get the rebate we promised, or the incentive we promised to them. There's a contract signed after the technical study where they agree to do, if they agree to do anything, it's spelled out what they will do and how much money we will give them, or the utility will give them on our say-so. And finally, then, we provide the incentives. And just as an example, in just one of the programs, the Pacific Gas Electric, it's about $2.5 million in incentives over 3 years, 2.5 years, a little over 2 years, actually. One of the characteristics, incidentally, of these kinds of projects we undertake at large industrial plants, it takes a long time to get a project done. First, you do these detailed technical analysis. You have to meet, negotiate, get agreement if they'll do anything, what they'll do. Then they might have to go to corporate headquarters to get that approved and get the remaining investment they have to make, and then have engineering design done, procurement, construction. So a project could take a year to be completed, and the incentive isn't paid until the very end, until it's put in and shown to be working. So in this case, this particular project, we vary the incentive. That's not necessarily true in the other programs or in programs like this in general. Often the incentive is fixed, but in this one, the budget is based on 9 cents a kilowatt hour for the electric savings and 40 cents a therm for the gas savings. But we can vary up or down to get a target 2-year payback period, which is usually sufficient to get a customer to go forward. Next one. So to give you an idea of the budgets of these three programs, up in Oregon, it's currently, and it has been, about $10-11 million a year. Of that, well, I have that in the next slide. Let me hold off. The Southern California Edison program is a total of $18 million for the 3 years or 2+ years, and PG&E is $8 million for the little over 2-year term. Next slide. In all cases, they were funded through public benefit. And incidentally, there's a lot of resistance to an assessment on the utility bill. The industrial customers are usually allied in objecting to the utility efficiency programs, and they don't want to see their price go up because it makes them less economic. But we can turn that on the head because it's there in California. And we go to the customer and say, look, your electric bill's $10 million a year. If it's 2%, it's close to that in California, you're paying $200,000 a year into this fund. Now, why don't you get some of that back? We have the incentive, and we can give it back to you if you proceed to install some efficient equipment. So in Oregon, what we get is $2 million. And the Energy Trust of Oregon, once we say a project is completed successfully, they pay the incentive directly, about $9 million a year. The Industrial Efficiency Program, Southern Cal Edison, our services are about $10 million for the whole life of the program. But one thing I didn't mention, there are 5 other contractors doing that program. We're kind of the lead contractor and overseeing, to some extent, the work of the others. I review the studies they do on behalf of Southern Cal Edison and see if they should move forward or not. So, and we do some other broader things that justify that. And the Southern Cal Edison writes the incentive check once we tell them that the project has been completed satisfactorily, about $8 million for the 2+ year program. Heavy industry, PG&E, it's different. We have a total of $8 million, and we have to take the incentives out of that, and they're expected to be that $2.5 million level. And we only get paid in this program if there's savings. And that's another program design feature that could be considered, that hold the contractor's feet to the fire, that you can't just go off and spend money and do it, but we'll only pay you when the savings are either committed or completed. There's a three-step project process in PG&E that we get paid, but it's only when savings are committed, there's a signed contract that they'll proceed, we get 30%. When they actually order equipment, we get another little percentage, and then the balance when the project is completed and installed. So that's the FUP, fixed unit price type of contract. And services cover managing the program, all the marketing and customer outreach and signing them up, doing the technical studies and other support to the participants, such as the inspections and assistance with procurement. And that's the end of my story. If you just flip up the last one, that's who I am. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Bill. Okay. All right. Next up is Mark.
My name is Mark Millen. I work with ICF International. We are a large consulting firm with five main practice areas. I work within one of those, which is called the Energy and Resources Practice. Within the Energy and Resources Practice, we do implementation of energy efficiency programs, much like the other speakers here today. My focus has been, and hopefully always will be, residential, as it's the closest to my own heart, and that's what I'm here to talk with you about today. One of the projects that we've worked on the longest is the Energy Star programs. ICF International actually was the program implementer for Energy Star when the programs actually came into inception. Back in 1991, the first program was launched. That was actually Green Lights. Today I'm here to talk to you about two programs that have been previously mentioned by Chris, Home Performance with Energy Star and Energy Star New Homes. First and foremost, a little bit about the Energy Star brand. It's a co-sponsored program from both EPA and DOE. It's a voluntary program. It's essentially a public-private partnership to try and promote energy efficiency in the marketplace. 64% of American households recognize the Energy Star brand now. This was as of a study done in 2004, so this should be actually higher. 54% of Americans that purchase an Energy Star product would actively encourage, influence their decision to buy Energy Star products in the future. Okay. First program I want to talk about today is Home Performance with Energy Star. This was mentioned earlier, and you know, whether it's an energy efficiency program or market transformation program, I would say it's more of a market transformation program because we are trying to make significant changes in the way homes are improved today. And so Home Performance, you know, we like to refer to it as a whole house program with contractor participation and quality assurance. We're going out in the marketplace and trying to create an infrastructure of contractors that can deliver whole house improvements. Building science was mentioned earlier by Chris. Building science is the foundation for these improvements. Why a whole house approach? Well, there's enormous opportunity with existing housing. The average age of an existing home today is actually about 30 years old. And why is that significant? Because it means that the average house was built before the advent of energy codes. So there's a huge opportunity to get into existing homes and make improvements on existing systems. Why a whole house approach? Capture synergies between multiple measures. What exactly does that mean? And we heard about HVAC retrofit programs where you're targeting an improvement to either the AC system or the furnace system. You mentioned some opportunities that might be missed in the thermal envelope. Air sealing, basically the exterior walls or attic plane where the ceiling of the home meets the attic. Or duct systems. So why do these things play into each other? Well, if I was a regular homeowner and I had a problem in my home, I wanted to find out why I was uncomfortable. And the utility might be offering a furnace program. to upgrade the furnace to a higher efficient furnace. So I call a participating contractor. They come in. I say, I'm uncomfortable in this room. They say, well, it's because your system's not large enough. We can replace that with a more energy efficient unit, and you can access these rebates. Well, that's great. Let's go ahead and do that. So now you have a system that might be installed on the furnace side, or it could be on the AC side, which may be even larger than the system that was there in the first place, but you haven't made any improvements to the home. So you've had the homeowner pay for a system that is much larger than they actually needed if they had made some common sense, highly cost-effective upgrades, like performing air sealing in the home, correcting duct system problems, or just doing some basic maintenance to make sure the heating and cooling system is running correctly. Proper installation is another huge lost area. Additional customer benefits, affordability, obviously energy savings, comfort. I mentioned, you know, why that call could have happened. I have an uncomfortable room. And the existing homes programs, many of the inquiries that come in are actually tied to comfort issues. You know, we have a bonus room over the garage that we can't keep warm in the winter. We have one room that it seems like we're not getting any flow to from the heating and cooling system. You know, it's always hot in the summers and it's always cold in the winters. Well, the Home Performance Energy Star takes a building science approach. So they're looking to solve the problem and improve the whole efficiency of the home. Health, safety, durability of the home all come into play when you look at a Home Performance Energy Star program. To give you an overview of what it means to have home performance with Energy Star done on your house, it starts off with complete visual and diagnostic inspection. So let's say I'm interested in improving my home. I call a contractor. It's an HVAC contractor. They're going to talk to me about improving my HVAC system. In home performance, you call a home performance contractor. They come out and they say, we do things a little different. We're going to take a look at your whole house, do an evaluation of the inside, the outside, all the different components that make up the house as a system, and we're going to make the most cost-effective recommendations. They're going to do some duct diagnostic testing, air infiltration testing, see how leaky the home is, how connected to the outside. They're going to do some duct testing. You got ducts in your attic, for instance. Typically, new construction ductwork still leaks upwards of 20% of the conditioned air into unconditioned spaces. So you can imagine that existing homes, especially very old ones, have significantly more problems. And generally, most of those have been installed without a whole lot of thought given to the design of the system. Now, the key part of what makes Home Performance with Energy Star different is its focus is on getting improvements installed in the home. So not only will this contractor go through this analysis, but they'll also complete the energy savings. So they'll put forth a proposal and says, these are the main opportunities in your house. If we do this, this is how it will interact with this different component. So we can add insulation in your home. We can do a comprehensive air sealing package. We have some duct system problems. One of the main ones is sealing up your duct system. And now we're going to be able to put in an air conditioner that's smaller than the one you have in there, but a high efficiency one. So it's looking at a comprehensive approach. And you have contractors that sometimes provide all the services or team with other contractors. Foremost, there's quality assurance involved in this, and the contractor side of things, they test out. They make sure that they're leaving the house in a healthy and safe environment. So they're making sure that they did not impact any of the systems negatively by work that they perform, something that can't be said by the majority of contractors. Quality assurance, the programs, as they're launched, go out and they inspect the work of contractors to ensure that they are delivering a whole house approach, health, safety, comfort, and meeting the ideals of the program. So common locations, this is just a representation of where errors can leak out of the home. The attic floor or the ceiling on your top level is really usually one of the main opportunities for air sealing. There's usually many connections between that living space and your attic, and air can easily flow, conditioned air. And so this kind of shows the cycle of where air can infiltrate into the home in a summer environment, go up through the house, and leak out the top into the attic. Duct improvements, whether it's ducts that have been installed poorly, you know, even in new construction today, flex ducts are very common, and you have flex ducts that take 5 90-degree turns before they actually get to the vent where it's supposed to be delivering air. Or there's not a whole lot of space in the floor system because of plumbing pipes that the pipe may be supposed to be 8 inches and it's actually crammed down to maybe 2 or 3 inches. So reduction in airflow tends to be a huge problem here. Air sealing is of duct work or duct sealing is usually the main opportunity. Again, you're seeing upwards of 30-40% in existing homes of conditioned air being lost in unconditioned spaces. So what is home performance not? It's not a label for a house. So if you have home performance done, you can't say I have an Energy Star home. That is the new construction program, so it doesn't overlap with it. However, you could essentially improve a home to such an extent that it qualifies for new homes, but with new specifications that would require a comprehensive rehab. Invasive, I should say. It's not an energy audit. There's lots of energy audits been launched throughout the years by utility programs that they can either come out and do a checkboard audit on your home, tell you where some of the opportunities are. Usually where the audit programs stop is actually getting the improvements implemented. And that's why home performance is not an audit program. A home assessment and evaluation of all the systems of the house is a core piece of what is done, but it is not the goal of the program. And it's not just a process for improving home energy efficiency. It is the goal, that's why the program's been launched, to save energy efficiency, but you're also looking at improving other areas. You may actually explore renewable in some of the programs. You're focusing on moisture problems. You're focusing on comfort problems. You're providing real solutions for homeowners, so additional benefits beyond saving money. I mentioned that it focuses on the cost-effective options. You know, usually it's presented in such a way as, you know, these are the most cost-effective improvements, so you can't have a window contractor coming in and saying, I'm going to save you 35% on your heating and cooling bills in a home performance with Energy Star program, because if you're not doing air sealing and insulation first, you're missing the boat, so to speak. Big opportunities for saving, certainly fixing many different problems that exist in homes today, and those can be minor fixes from, as I say, smashed ducts, disconnected ducts, sealing duct systems, providing air sealing, relatively low-cost measures but high return. Homeowners with high bills, you know, certainly this helps with utilities in times of rate increases where they can actually help high bill complaints and target a program that will actually help their customers out. Helps your local economy. It capitalizes on your existing contractor base. It focuses on going out there, educating contractors, teaching them about building science, teaching them how to do these improvements in the home, helping facilitate purchase of equipment in some cases, facilitating the training, and creating an infrastructure to deliver the program. And of course, why EPA is involved, it's good for the environment. All these houses use less energy, thereby less energy needs to be generated, and thereby you save pollution. Just to look at a couple of regional programs, New York was kind of the guinea pig for home performance with Energy Star, so to speak. They were the first to launch. They were highly involved in developing the program. They launched in 2001. There are right about 11,000 homes. I think the actual update through 2006 is closer to 13,000. They're looking at 10,000 megawatt hours a year of electricity saved thus far. 1.7 megawatts in demand savings. 420,000 MMBTUs of fossil fuels, although saving of fossil fuels isn't the objective of the program. Electric savings is. Average monthly savings to homeowners is the key, where it hits the bottom line for your customer base, $630 average annual savings for people who undergo home performance with Energy Star in New York. Austin Energy Program, focused on a municipal utility with a smaller service area. They did 1,400 projects in 2005, 70 participating contractors, and peak demand reduction of 3,000 kW. Wisconsin has another statewide home performance with Energy Star program. Their average home saves 1,100 kWh and 500 therms of natural gas. Okay. So what can you expect cost effectiveness-wise on home performance? Well, a levelized cost of conserved energy would be about 5 cents a kWh. If you look at NYSERDA's program, which does cost effectiveness evaluation, a comprehensive evaluation process to do a total resource cost calculation. So your standard total resource cost, just looking, you know, purely energy focused really, you can get 1.4, or the program is cost effective. If you look on other benefits such as health, safety, environmental benefits, you know, other components, that figure raises to 2.7. Go ahead. Building blocks, EPA, the Department of Energy, and also HUD have worked together to provide funding to an organization called Building Performance Institute. They've developed basically an accreditation process for contractor companies and certification for individuals. So they've established standards that programs can capitalize on and adopt to develop their programs. And this is how you can focus on building a contractor infrastructure. Expanding Deliver Nationally, BPI has been, you know, focusing on growing through this grant, bringing BPI affiliates or affiliates that can provide testing certification services, also trying to get more BPI training organizations available out in the marketplace. So this is one area that programs can focus on capitalizing on the existing infrastructure. Regional programs, you know, how can a program help if something was to come out of this process energy efficiency-wise? How can it help get it into the marketplace? Well, home performance is happening. We have spot cases all around the country where we have contractors that have gotten into this on their own volition. They've done home performance contracting because they were exposed to it and believe it's right. But building a contractor infrastructure and providing quality training and mentoring, so getting the word out to the contractor, contractors in your market. There may be five contractors capable in Pennsylvania to deliver a whole house approach right now. There may be, you know, another 20 that dabble in components of it. Be a trusted third-party messenger. The biggest thing is, you know, making marketing and communications, telling about the program and about its participants. And helping secure preferred financing tends to help the program, a lower rate. Pennsylvania already has the Keystone Help Program. That would be, you know, that type of a program attached to a home performance would be highly effective. This is where home performance with Energy Star is nationally. A lot of localized areas where it's being implemented by either smaller utilities or nonprofits in specific markets. Some statewide programs in Vermont, aforementioned New York, Wisconsin. Some that are going to launch in New Jersey coming up. I'd like to touch on Energy Star new homes quickly here as well. It's kind of the flip side. You know, if you're looking at improving your existing housing stock, well, you should also look at trying to stop inefficient homes from being built so that program doesn't have to last forever. Go ahead. So what is Energy Star New Home? Essentially, it's looking to minimize the amount of energy needed to control the interior environment. It's about 15 to 20% more efficient than a home built to code. So with the advancing codes, it's saving 15% on heating, cooling, hot water, some lighting and appliances. And it's required that it passes a third-party certification. The certification for the individual to verify an Energy Star home has many components which could be tied into what a home performance contractor would need to know for existing homes. So launching these two programs together and capitalizing on synergies between them would be a great way to capitalize on building a contractor infrastructure, so you're tying it into both programs. Energy Star New Homes today, about 560,000 as of the end of 2005 nationally. Energy Star homes have been built. Tack on about another 250,000 from last year, so we're really up close to 800,000 homes. This shows you some relative market penetrations. Why this is important, if you look at two major utility programs in Texas, many utility programs in California promoting it, New York with a statewide Energy Star program. Florida hits the mark because they just have a really lot of homes built. The program can play a huge role in getting this into the marketplace. Iowa actually hits because it has one, you know, relatively large utility focusing on delivering the program. But we know it works with industry, that it helps home builders, and it makes sense for them because we have markets like Nevada and Arizona, which have huge market penetrations and no utility support, no program support. Obviously, those have been in part driven by climate. But even in states like Ohio and Indiana, where they have higher market penetrations, programs haven't existed. But programs can help launch us into a marketplace. Just a quick look at where we are market penetration-wise. I'd like to raise that there's 1% of the new homes built in 2005 in Pennsylvania qualified for the Energy Star program. So there is a huge opportunity in Pennsylvania on new construction. If you compare that to Texas, where 25% is, you see some of the disparity of how a program can influence this. Energy Stars Now for New Homes is based on IECC 2004. Pennsylvania has adopted IECC 2006, which is very similar in its energy efficiency requirements. So it's ramped up. We've had the increase in NACA, which was alluded to earlier, to 13 SEER, basically removing a lot of the savings associated with improving a 10 SEER, which was the previous standard, to a 12. It was usually the upgrade, and now it's even higher than that. So we've kind of expanded and looked for other opportunities, and HVAC best practices and installation was one of those areas. Insulation is another one of those areas. It's a little bit of a tongue twister, but when you talk about most people, they may understand what insulation is. They know they have an R13 bat in their wall, but if it's not properly installed, that R13 bat may perform as bad as an R6. So that's one of the components that was added to the program within the last year. Moisture control and air barrier details, and I'll touch base on these things as well. So what makes up an ENERGY STAR new home? Typically effective insulation. So this is insulation that is installed correctly with full R value, and so that's a component of the program. Not really asking for you to raise the levels from IECC, just asking for it to be installed correctly. High performance windows, switching to a low E double pane product is a typical upgrade for an ENERGY STAR home. Tight construction, so you're looking at minimizing those problems in an existing home by building a tight house, potentially providing mechanical ventilation to bring in fresh air, and then also looking at your duct systems and reducing what would be standard duct leakage of 20%+ down to less than 8 or even less than 6 in some cases. Highly efficient heating and cooling equipment. Well, we already said cooling really isn't there. In this market, you're not really going to go above a 13 SEER, so you're going to focus on raising the efficiency of your furnace or a heat pump if you were running all electric. Lighting and appliances were added to the ENERGY STAR spec in the last year, so you're targeting the other loads that play a component into this whole picture. And then, of course, third-party verified. This is a little bit fuzzy, but this basically is the HERS index. It's the industry that developed a home energy rating system. It's run by ResNet, which is Residential Energy Services Network. They created a scale of 1 to 100. 100 is a code home. It is a 2004 IECC compliant code home. 0 is a home that uses absolutely no energy. So ENERGY STAR falls in at about an 85 in Pennsylvania, which is 15% better than code. If you had an existing home, which was built 30 years ago, it may score 140 on that, or 40% worse than code. This gives you just a little bit. We don't have the time to go through it, but it sets certain standards that there are ENERGY STAR products going in, that you have a tight exterior envelope or your exterior walls and ceiling. Duct work is going in tight, and you know specifications on including ENERGY STAR qualified equipment. And then one of the key components here is solar is not included in the scoring and qualification for ENERGY STAR. So we are looking at a core base of energy efficiency, and then yes, go ahead and add solar on it, but let's improve the house as much as we can first. We've added quality components. It's called the thermal bypass checklist, which we need to find a little bit better marketability for. If anyone has suggestions for a new name, I'm all ears. But essentially, it's a quality inspection list looking at details. You can go ahead and go to the next slide. Looking at basically 16 different common areas where details are done poorly in new construction. And those are inspected in every ENERGY STAR home to be guaranteed they have been developed right, that it has the right air sealing details, that it has the right blocking going in, and that, of course, insulation is being installed correctly and with full value for your R. Okay. Again, I'll use NYSERDA's program just because they do such a great job with valuation. 6,500 new homes since 2001. You see some of the savings numbers, 0.9 megawatts. So this is using an electric focus program except in the Northeast. So if you compare that and contrast it to a program that's launched in Texas, you have a much different load scenario related to what you might accomplish on electric savings, specifically, of course, on the cooling side of things. So TXU's program, which is a fairly large program but centralized in its focus on one small area in Dallas-Fort Worth mainly, they have probably upwards of 45,000 housing starts in their service territory. And they probably have 100 plus large production builders or builders that build high volume of houses. Compare that to New York, where they may have three large production builders, and they're probably smaller than all 100 in Dallas. So you have a much different market. New York has participants in the 700 home builder range. TXU really, you know, it has 30 core partners, and it may have 100 overall, but 30 core partners that produce homes. Their target goal was 13,000. They pay incentives out to 13,000 homes last year. The market actually has many more homes than that. But taking credit for that, 27 million kWh of electricity and 32 megawatts just last year alone. Go ahead. Again, cost effectiveness wise, you're looking at about 6 cents, which for levelized cost of conserved energy for Energy Star new homes. And then some of the metrics for NYSERDA's cost effectiveness, 2.7 just on true TRC. Okay. Contact information for myself, and I support the program on behalf of EPA. Dale Hoffmeyer, the program manager for home performance with Energy Star, and Sam Rashkin, the program manager for Energy Star new homes. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Mark. And last one in this panel is Ruben. And Ruben, you take the time that you need. Oh, he's not.
Thank you. I'm Ruben Brown from the E-Cube Company, LLC, which is based in New York City. We provide strategic energy services, and I'm going to identify myself by the kinds of things we are doing today. We finished a power purchase contract for a 45-unit apartment house and 70,000 square foot supermarket this morning. It's in a retrofitted warehouse building with 2 foot thick brick walls from 1863 or 2. We are today here talking to you about residential micro CHP and in Providence in Rhode Island negotiating with a legislatively mandated distributed generation working group. We are at an ISO New England negotiation on the role of demand resources in the wholesale market. And the issues of today's discussion have to do with how many emergency generators could operate in the situation. And we represent some of the demand response folks in the discussion. I'm going to rush through my presentation because the debate on that began 10 minutes ago, and I'd like to get into it on the phone in about 10 minutes or 15 minutes because of the concerns I have. I use the micro CHP example, one client, one structure. The client is Climate Energy. They have, they're a joint venture of ECR International, which is located in Western New York. It's the largest furnace and boiler manufacturer in New York, with Yankee Scientific, which has engineered some of the most efficient furnaces in the country. Why is this immediately relevant to this conversation? Simple. Last year in Pennsylvania, approximately 146,000 gas air furnaces and gas cast iron boilers were purchased by people that are presumably replacing them on a 20-year cycle or a 15 to 20-year cycle. What has been added by the technology we're going to walk through is the use of that existing home resource and that existing gas feedstock to generate electricity in the home cleanly, safely, in a plug-and-play situation. Let's go ahead to the next slide. Or actually, these are houses in Massachusetts where the installations went in last winter. Okay, here's the comparison. You've got a million megawatts of thermal capacity in the space heating appliance industry over the last decade. Total electrical installed capacity, 800,000 megawatts. Next slide. So electric power from your heating system, small-scale cogeneration, combined heat and power, micro CHP, the concept is essentially 1 to 5 kilowatts. Fuel, heat, and electricity. Now, if you noticed back in the first slide, there was a symbol for Honda. Honda's generators are at the heart of this process, along with ECR's furnace. Next slide. Micro CHP needs to be affordable, practical, the right capacity, low emissions and grid connectivity, and quiet. It's all of the above. If we had the white box, which is a trailer that we tow around to places to look at, sitting outside, you could walk outside and get warm standing in a trailer with the back door open and hear no noise. The emissions are one-third of that of a conventional power plant you're comparing to. It's source versus distributed emissions. Yes, you do have emissions, but they're de minimis. Next slide. So micro CHP could be the next thing, a big thing in residential capacity. I do not normally make commercial presentations of my clients' materials, but we think that this teaches the principle. You got to be in the right place at the right time. And I'm going to come back to the simple reason you all are in the room. 90% of the regulatory processes in this country result in settled conclusions. They're not heavily litigated. So you all are negotiating with these folks the solutions that come out. You know, as much as we pride ourselves on heavy litigation, the fact of the matter is consensus drives things. We want that consensus to include micro CHP. Now, solar and syngas and ethanol are, you know, down the road and a lot more expensive than this. Let's go ahead. Okay, so Popular Mechanics has recognized this technology as Breakthrough Product Award for 2006. The system you can see is very simple. It's a furnace on one side and a generating unit on the other. You can pull the sound baffle off and you can hear the motor running when the generator is going. This operates when your heating season's going. So you're going to have 4,500, 5,000 kilowatts of production from this machine during your heating season. A perverse set of incentives, market incentives or otherwise, that say you can only get benefits out of these programs if you are in place at the time of PJM's peak, that hot day in July, etc., discriminates against something that is base load in the wintertime. Next slide. So grid-connected, professionally installed space water heating appliances generate significant electric power as a byproduct. We've already said this. Provide self-powering emergency backup and grid support. Next slide. So here are the numbers. 1.2 kilowatts. You know, it's not 5 kilowatts like or 10 kilowatts like a McMansion might use. It's the base load that would be driven while your heating season is going on. Comfort is the result of this. Stable temperatures in your household and electricity reducing your bill. Total efficiency is between 85 and 90%. We heard mention of the DOE efficiency standards on appliances that are being reviewed, coming up maybe to 84%. This meets those criteria. You're really looking, as we'll see in a moment, at 85 to 95% efficiency. 30,000 units in the Japanese configuration have been sold and installed in Japan. We have a North American product here. It's quiet. Next slide. Two units side by side, furnace on the left, a generating unit on the right. Next. This gives you a feel for the household. See that surplus power going to the grid? This is a situation that needs net metering. You need to be able to put the electricity back out at this stage. The technology eventually will be, within a year or two, grid isolatable, but you don't need it for now. But you do need to put your extra kilowatt hours out. At night, you may not be using 1.2 kilowatts in your house. You'll be heating your house. So on. Next slide. So, you know, you got a service provider. The Climate Energy Office communicates. The owner can access the information of what's happening to your furnace. You can reset it. You can change your temperature or whatever. You know, it's all modern things you can reach by internet. Would do. These dots in Massachusetts are where last year's preliminary machines were. The fully UL approved machines will be, we'll have about 200 of them in the market this year. And the following year go up dramatically. Next slide, please. So, benefits to the homeowner: significantly reduced electric bills. Might not be 50% here in Pennsylvania. It might be 30%. Reduced gas rate in Connecticut, to borrow the Connecticut example, you can, your gas delivery charges are waived for any CHP, and these are eligible for that as well. You've got backup power supply in the event of grid outage. You reduced impact on the environment with no lifestyle change. Like most of the more modern furnaces that are coming along, you can keep comfort going. You know, it doesn't cycle up and down and the temperature move up and down. Your house is going to stay whatever you set it at. Go ahead. Okay, benefits to the electric system: reduced need for generation and reduced need for distribution of power. You've got a new low-cost peak demand resource. Next slide. Okay, here's the output. Okay, you can see it in the heating season, winter and fall on the sides. Approximately 5,000 hours per year controlled by the home thermostat. In the summertime, or you can run these machines at 2 kilowatts for 50 to 300 hours if you need it. Once again, if you get into a perverse program design that says you have to operate 12 months, and that is one of the perverse results of a settlement negotiation in the ISO New England for capacity, which they're all up there trying to implement right now, is if your aggregator commits to the programs at the ISO to get paid for capacity, you got to deliver it all year, or you get docked in some way. So this has to be blended with composite resources, maybe from Chris Neamey's other projects or whatever, to fill in around those, you know, skinny spikes in the summertime when you're needed. Next slide, please. What we're proposing that you consider is a pilot, and in 30 years of stimulating pilots of all kinds up and down the East Coast, including an inventory of low-head hydro in Pennsylvania 30 years ago for Alice Chalmers Hydro Turbine Corporation in York, I'm very keen to get something moving because it brings information and decisions. We propose 1,000 homes, 1 to 2 megawatts, 2 years duration, temporary rules we'll identify in a moment. A fully developed long-term program, we're suggesting that you take the turnover rate or replacement of household furnaces and cast iron boilers and target 20% of those to be turned into micro CHP systems, whether it's this company's product or some other. That would be approximately 30,000 homes based on the 2005 sales of furnaces and cast iron boilers in Pennsylvania. Next slide, please. Once again, temporary rules. Simple, recognize sensitive economics on both sides of the utility and the customer. Must be practical for heating installation contractor, homeowner, and the two utilities to be involved. It's so dang practical in Massachusetts right now that National Grid, whose experts sat on the interconnection negotiation committees at IEEE, after his second home visit, now he's looking at thousands of these things in the next few years, said, send me a photograph to prove that it has been plugged in to the wall. I don't want to make another visit. It's too reliable. Recognize that micro CHP has a potential long-term role in meeting energy needs in a variety of ways. Needs to be sorted out, and they anticipate full equity to all parties under long-term rules that can be developed. Next. Here are some of the samples. Distributed generation gas discount, which is a New York model. for residential systems that use gas in these ways, DG. It's also available in Connecticut on the transport portion of the gas. A single gas meter, rather than having two, because it's it's not that much additive to the household gas. True net electric metering, a single bidirectional meter. I believe your regulations permit that, based on my review, I believe, but maybe somebody can correct me on that. If so, we would urge you, at least for the pilot, to consider doing it this way. Grid interconnection under simplified rules and procedures, the MADRI recommendations to PJM that you've employed and that we've monitored for a year and a half, do not really get in the way of this process. This is in the under 10 kilowatt category, and it also is under the FERC guidelines that PJM has. In fact, you don't have to have aggregation and control for summer peak grid support in a temporary phase. And once in another year or so, when the systems are autonomous, you can run them on propane and the like. And the hydronic systems will be available, water-based ones. You could go more fully to the grid support. Next slide. So, we're suggesting that, immediately the warm air micro CHP retail sales can begin and move into the market in Pennsylvania. And the water-based or hydronic system would be available at the end of the year. We don't know how program design flows around this. What we are seeing in New England and New York is a strong interest on the part of the gas distribution companies to help assist with the cost of the machines move them into market. Next slide. So we're back. How to make it fit, and we stand available to participate in negotiations to bring it to focus and other micro CHP vendors to the table if you want to see them. Our goal is to use the indigenous resource that you have right now, which is the feedstock to your furnaces, and do it as effectively as possible, as soon as possible. Thank you. I am concluded. My name is Reuben Brown, and the slide on identity is on the disc on the desk there, but it's not on the one on the website that he's using, so I'm going to leave the disc for you all to transfer to the website, and that information is there. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Reuben. We are going to take a break because we still have quite a bit of material to cover, but we're just going to ask that you try to get back, say, in about 7 minutes instead of 15. 305-ish.